Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
I'm very happy to be here, and I want to welcome you all to the Q&A session with Dr. Dawn. So I wanted to put this out. Some of you may not yet have gotten your flu vaccination, and it's definitely time, right after Halloween is what I always advise, because in our local Monterey Bay area anyway, the flu really starts to hit generally in January. That's when we see most of our cases. It can start as early as Thanksgiving. All those lovely children coming from all over the place to visit, little culture media they are, always causes a bump in respiratory illnesses. So remember, you wash your hands before you put anything, and I mean anything, in your mouth, assuming that your hands are doing the job of carrying it into your mouth. Also, the timing of when you get your flu shot actually makes a difference. A recent study done at the University of Birmingham looked at the change in antibody titers. That's how many protective antibodies you get after a shot. And what they found was that because of a body clock, our circadian rhythm, right, our diurnal rhythms, your immune response is greatest in the morning. So a morning vaccination produces a much better antibody response than an afternoon vaccination. And the effect is particularly important if you're over 65. And of course, that's the group that is at highest risk for getting a post-influenza pneumonia and ending up in the hospital or, well, God forbid, but it does happen, even dead. So when you hear about those deaths from flu, in the statistics from CDC or wherever, many of those are in individuals who actually, well, let's just say they were over 65 and they died of pneumonia, but the flu kicked the legs out from under them so that they couldn't fight the bacterial infection. So very, very important. If you haven't gotten your flu shot yet, try to schedule it in the morning rather than in the evening. I'm going to read an email now from Ashley in Charlotte, North Carolina. Ashley writes, I am a 39-year-old female. I'll describe myself as someone who has always been prone to nausea and motion sickness. However, as I've aged, it's become a much bigger problem. I now experience nausea and motion sickness almost daily. I experience motion sickness even when I'm driving, as opposed to being the passenger. I do know some culprits. If I look at my phone at a stoplight, the issue is exacerbated. If I've had some drinks, particularly wine, the night before, I will also experience more motion sickness for several days. Caffeine also contributes. These are the obvious culprits, and I'm attempting to change my behavior. I have a history of migraines, but they're now well controlled with Botox. My neurologist feels this is all related to the migraines, and even though my pain may be well controlled, he maintains that the nerves are still agitated, and this is contributing to my motion sickness. I also have a history of hyperemesis, that means excessive vomiting, with all three pregnancies. I had a Zofran pump with two of them, and my nausea was still pretty poorly controlled. I had a full remission of my migraines during pregnancy, which makes me question my neurologist connecting the two. One other small detail. I get norovirus or the stomach bug more frequently than anyone I know and seem to take longer to recover than most. With small children in the house, I'm constantly exposed. I've had my microbiome analyzed, and my results were excellent. However, that's defined. I had a very diverse and healthy microbiome. I eat a healthy omnivore diet, and I'm an avid yogi. Do you have any thoughts, and can you recommend a functional medicine physician near Charlotte, North Carolina? Okay, well, starting with the last question, which is perhaps interesting to the international audience, you can go now to www.functionalmedicine.org and find a list of functional medicine practitioners from all over the world. We have people in China, we have people in Brazil, Germany, Sweden. We're so excited that functional medicine is taking off nationwide. It's just really blowing our minds. On top of that, this is something that anyone in the United States can do, and that's my recommendation to Ashley. When Ashley talks about getting the norovirus and taking longer to recover than most, I would love to know whether or not that also means gastrointestinal issues with vomiting, but I'm betting that it does. So my answer is going to predicate on that, because norovirus is a vomiting and diarrhea bug. This is the cruise ship virus, but it's also very common in daycare settings. And so, well, if you have small children, it's certainly an issue. So with respect to Ashley's problem, it could be an inner ear problem. And the first test, and she may have already had this with her neurologist, would be to start with an electronystagmogram. Let me say that again. Electronystagmogram. And this is a way to assess the inner ear functioning, which could be contributing here. And this is a mismatch between what the balance organ in your inner ear is telling your brain and what your eyes are telling your brain. And if there's a mismatch there in the signal, that will cause nausea very easily and exaggerated motion sickness. So that would be the very first thing to try. But if that doesn't pan out, I would hypothesize that the vomiting center in the brain has a low threshold. There's a part of the brain in the medulla, which is the lizard brain, kind of seated at the center of the top of your spinal cord and the real bottom core of the brain. And this area, the area postrema, is the part of the brain stem that actually tastes the blood. It's a little bit leaky, and it lets every little molecules through, and larger molecules than the rest of the brain would let cross. And it tastes the blood. And if it tastes something that it thinks is a toxin, well, like a plant alkaloid, for example, a mushroom toxin, then it triggers vomiting. If your area postrema, Ashley, is more leaky than normal, then that could cause you to have increased nausea in pregnancy, because you would be tasting more of the HCG hormone of pregnancy. And I think that really is a possibility. Now, all women with HCG producing tumors get hyperemesis. In fact, that's one of the things we check for, because you can get a uterine tumor from a failed pregnancy that actually grows and produces the hormone of pregnancy. And this can be an invasive and lethal cancer. So any of us who see women of gestational age are always watching for the possibility of that. But if this were more leaky than normal, that could be what's going on. There might be some way to calm that area down. And in terms of therapeutics, the first thing I would do would be to go out and get acupuncture at the Masters of the Heart or the pericardium 6 point. And if that seems to calm down your queasiness on the drive home from the acupuncture, or do something that would normally set it off, then you want to get one of these electric stimulator bracelets that they use on fishing boats. When I go out whale watching on the Monterey Bay, and anyone who ever has a chance to go out and see the big whales, you don't miss it. It's a real bucket list item. They're such amazing creatures. But it can be a little rocky out there on the ocean. And so the fine people at the Sanctuary Cruises provided me with a lovely little bracelet that gave me a tiny little electrical shock. I could wear it right over that acupuncture point, which is fairly easy to find. And the shock kept me from being queasy at all on an entire day cruising a very bumpy sea, something that ordinarily would have bothered me a lot. So what are we doing with the acupuncture? Well, we're talking to the nervous system in code, in what we might call the machine language of the nervous system. I don't know how they figured this out 5,000 years ago in China, but somehow they did. And I am just so impressed with the results on so many things that I was taught in medical school. It's like, live with it or take a drug. This is incurable. And I'm here to say it's not. And our next story is about a technology that could be the end of endoscopy. Now, upper endoscopy is a fairly unpleasant procedure. It involves taking a flexible tube and snaking it down your throat. Like crazy. And so you're sedated for this. And it's done very frequently. Anyone with an upper GI problem, anyone with a lower GI problem is lucky to get through a gastroenterology visit without an upper endoscopy, because this is a billable procedure. Sorry to be a little cynical about it. It's often necessary to prove that you don't have cancer, which is the doctor's duty as they see it, although you may be coming in for lower abdominal pain or diverticulitis, there's this tendency to do the upper procedure as well that, you know, until Medicare stops paying for it every time the doctor does it, is going to be the case. This is, by the way, why Medicare for All, which Kucinich was promoting back there 8 years ago, if you can remember that far back, in the Democratic primary, would have been such a disastrous, completely disastrous strategy. It would have bankrupted us even faster than we're currently on track to bankrupt Medicare. So back to this procedure. A simple swallow a sponge procedure. So one of those capsules with a string on it. The string is around the sponge. You swallow the sponge. The capsule melts. The sponge expands to about 25 millimeters. That's about an inch across. And then you simply let it float around in the stomach for 10 minutes and then pull it out by its cord. What's interesting is that what the researchers are looking for is they're looking for methylated DNA markers that discriminate Barrett's esophagus from a benign esophagitis. Barrett's is a precancerous condition, and we always want to find that Barrett's, because if we don't, it's disastrous. The patient could go on to develop cancer of the esophagus, which is a horrible disease. There's no way really to treat that and still allow the person to eat. Under most situations, there's multiple surgeries that have to be done. You just don't want to go there. Methylation of a nucleotide exchange factor, a gene in other words, and a couple of other protein genes were 100% specific and 100% sensitive for Barrett's esophagus. This is amazing, folks, because we don't have any tests that are 100% accurate in both the direction of not saying there's no disease when there is a disease, that's called a false negative, or not saying there is a disease when there isn't a disease, that's called a false positive. This is amazing. So this sponge is going to replace endoscopy. It might cost $200, whereas endoscopy with biopsy and CLO test runs about $2,000. So imagine that, a new technology being developed that actually saves money in healthcare. I'm amazed and happy that it actually exists. An email from Joni in Salinas. Dear Dr. Dawn, I recently heard you speak about a urine test that you give to hormone replacement therapy patients to determine their 4-hydroxy level in response to hormone replacement therapy. If I understood you correctly, the metabolization of synthetic estrogen could break the DNA, which indicates a risk for cancer. I asked my doctor about this, who had no idea what I was talking about. She'd like to understand more, and I would like to be able to thoroughly explain. As it is, I've been taking 0.25/5 milligrams of drospirenone estradiol for 3 months, and while I do have a maternal history of ovarian cancer, yet have tested negative on the BRCA1 and 2, I'm wondering if I can relax about my risk of taking hormone replacement therapy. Menopause symptoms are constant hot flashes and insomnia. They were killing me. I'm 58, otherwise healthy, and take no other medications. Thank you for clarifying this detail, and I love your program. Well, thank you, Joni, and please keep listening, even though since your email, we have switched to this new station. So, let's start with bioidentical hormone versus synthetic hormones. Synthetic progesterones are particularly dangerous, even more dangerous probably than synthetic estrogens. And the Women's Health study done back in 2002, which was so controversial and so explosive at its time, is a classic example of this. But they didn't understand their results. They misinterpreted them, and they blamed the estrogen. And it took another 3 or 4 years for the follow-up study to come out and show that, no, actually, the group that was just on estrogen, and this was a synthetic estrogen, or no, it wasn't. It was an animal estrogen called Premarin, which comes from pregnant mares. And the bottom line on that is it's an incredibly cruel way to get a chemical that we can easily synthesize from a vegetable protein. So I strongly discourage anyone from using Premarin just on the basis of its cruelty. The issue with the drugs that Joni is taking is that the progesterone that she's on is similar to the progesterone that was in the PremPro in that first study, and it is turned into it's bioconverted into estrogen on its way out of the body, and the form of estrogen it's converted into is estrone, and that is preferentially going to be converted into this 4-hydroxyestrone. 4-hydroxyestrone is toxic to DNA. It sticks to DNA like a burr on a sock. Well, that's fine until that cell needs to divide. And then when the cell tries to divide and the DNA splits, the burr is sitting on the code, and you can't read the code at that spot. So as the DNA replicates, what happens is that the replicator looks at that and goes, "Huh, I don't know what it is. I'll just make something up." And it puts a codon in there. That codon could be a codon in a place that is going to unlock an oncogene. It could be a codon that's going to turn on a gene that increases the reproduction, that maybe turns off the ability to read the stop reproducing signal. And in other words, it could be the last straw in setting up a cancer. You don't want to be doing that. So the synthetics are going to go that pathway. Some unfortunate women have changes in their DNA such that that pathway that creates the 4-hydroxy is very strong. And those women, I really encourage, first of all, I look for it in any woman who seems to has a strong family history of cancer but is BRCA 1 and 2 negative. This testing can be done fairly easy. You can take a 23andMe and go digging for the mutation. You can also test it functionally by just getting a urine and looking at the relative levels of 2-hydroxy and 4-hydroxyestrone. That test is widely available, but it is an alternative test. It is considered experimental by the insurance companies, so it'll be your $150 to pay for the test to reassure yourself that you are processing the drugs that you are taking well. And if anyone sends me an email at askdrdawn.com, you can get the information so that you can take it to your doctor and get that test ordered. We've got a caller here, Mike in Santa Cruz. Hello.
Before the break, you were talking about therapy in women for estrogen and menopause. And my situation is I'm living with inoperable prostate cancer. And they have me on testosterone-blocking therapy, Lupron shots periodically. And I'm wondering, if there's anything I should be concerned about there in terms of other side effects and potentially creating additional cancer risks.
I have a nice Lupron story that I'll share with you. It's regards my father, who got prostate cancer in his 60s and survived 13 years on Lupron therapy and eventually succumbed to a metastasis, but, you know, he had a very good response from it. And he'd always been the strong, silent type. I loved him, and I knew he loved me, but he couldn't talk to my dad. And whether it was the cancer diagnosis or the Lupron, but I think it was the Lupron, after he started on Lupron, he became very articulate, and we would have these wonderful long conversations, and he would spontaneously say things and comment on things, and it was just like something had shifted in his brain. I wonder, did you experience any changes in brain function or the way that your, vocal facility worked?
I would say something similar to that in terms of I'm much more in touch with, comfortable with, and able to articulate my emotions than I was prior to going on the Lupron therapy.
It just goes to show that these hormones that come out of our gonads go back and affect our brain in very substantial ways. Anyway, so Lupron turns off the sex hormones pretty much entirely. You still make a little bit of hormones from your adrenal glands, but it's really a minuscule amount. And since the testosterone sex hormone is part of what drives the growth of prostate cancer, this is the reasoning behind its use. And as I've pointed out, it is a successful therapy. The problem is when you turn off the sex hormones, the other thing that you're going to get is bad bone balance. So you'll start to build bone slower and slower, and the speed that you break down bone is going to remain pretty much the same. Normally, we're in a dynamic balance where we've got, think about bricklayers, and you've got a crew that's taking the bricks from the wall on one end and knocking off the mortar and putting them aside to be recycled, and then you've got another group of guys who are building on the other end of the wall, and it's a circular wall, and they just loop around, and that way the wall is always fresh, and that's how our bone balance works. But if the guys who are building slow down and the guys who are breaking it down speed up, then you can see that relatively speaking, that wall is going to get narrower and narrower, or in the case of our bones, weaker and weaker. So there are a number of things you can do that will help that, and I hope you're doing them. I'll tell you about them in a moment, but you had a follow-up.
Well, I was going to say, they do have me taking a calcium supplement.
That's good, but you also need to be taking vitamin K, a specific type of vitamin K called MK7. And the reason you want to take this is because this type of vitamin is a signal to the calcium, and it tells the calcium to go to your bones, and it tells the calcium to stay out of your arteries. You may have encountered some data or read articles about calcium supplementation being linked to heart disease. And what we think in functional medicine is going on is that there's not enough vitamin K in the system, and so some of the calcium ends up in the arteries, and the stiffer arteries are more likely to become a problem as far as breaking open and triggering a heart attack, because it's like a chip of paint on the inside of the tube, and that chip of paint attracts platelets, and those platelets form a clot, and suddenly you block the blood vessel with this big lump of platelets like a football pileup or something. And so what you want to do is definitely about 100 micrograms of MK7, and you can find that at health food stores. It's a little hard to find at your local CVS, but you can find it at most of the health food stores that have fairly extensive vitamins, and of course you can find it online. Another thing that you want to take is boron, because boron helps with bone formation. And a third thing you want to take is some vitamin X, because weight-bearing exercise, particularly bouncing, is very good. There's been some work done with vibrating plates, and you can see sometimes at health food, at health clubs, or sometimes chiropractor's office, they'll have these plates that vibrate, and you just stand on them, and they're supposed to, you know, help you develop your muscles. I'm not so sure about that, but I do think that the data on maintaining bone mass is worthwhile, and so if you can figure out a way to stand in a place where the floor is vibrating, you're probably doing your bones some good. And if you can jump up and down or bounce up and down on your heels without hurting your knees or your hips or your feet, that's also a really good way to do it. I don't know about trampolines. Some people say that works. I haven't seen any studies that prove it, but definitely weight-bearing exercise is key in maintaining muscle mass, but the vibration is good because it goes up the spinal column, and that's also an extremely important place that we want to keep strong. So I hope that helped and answered your question.
Thanks, it's very helpful. Oh, one other thing, what sort of dosage should I be thinking of on the boron?
About 3 milligrams daily.
Okay, and the vitamin X?
The vitamin X is exercise.
Oh,
so
gotcha.
Dose as tolerated.
Okay, thank you, doctor.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. And our next caller is Verita in Santa Cruz. Hello, Verita. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
No, you're welcome.
I wanted to ask you about insomnia and what's actually happening with the brain when we're not sleeping. And I've tried lots of different sleep remedies, valerian, hops, shishandra, you know, the poppy, and none of them really seem to work. The way my insomnia hits is I can feel a little restless before I go to bed. I lay down, I close my eyes, and I just get a jolt. I feel like I've had a, you know, a cup of cappuccino or something. And it's a little bit of a, like a body rush, and then the mind chatter starts. And once that starts, I do my best to try to fall asleep, but it just is to no avail. I watch my breath. I, you know, practice good visualization. It's still just, there's just no, I never reach that place of relaxation and drifting off into sleep. And I've had this now for almost 6 months.
I want to ask you about your habits. What do you do in the couple of hours before bedtime?
I generally would say I'm listening to simple music, got the lights down low, just pretty much relaxing.
All right, so you're not doing any of the wrong things like,
no,
like
computer screens,
blue
or
LED lights or stuff like that. So it sounds like you've done your homework.
Yeah.
And what about in the morning? What time do you normally get up in the morning?
I would say my general waking, I'm usually not even asleep, but I would say somewhere between 7:30 in the morning, I'm up.
All right.
And I've pretty recently, I would say within the last 6 months, pretty much given up caffeine or coffee in the morning. Sometimes I might have a very small amount, but I usually have an herbal tea or dandy blend, something like that in the morning.
One of the things that I think would be really helpful for you is to get bright light in your face early in the morning. So if you're getting up at 7:30, if there's a place where you can get a lot of light through the window, ideally go outside. I know we're turning into winter, but if you can bundle up and sit on the deck and have that tea, for example, if that works for you. But the more light you get in your face, and if you can run, I don't know how old you are or what your physical situation is, but if you can even take a brisk walk or a run, the combination of the light in your eyes and exercise in the morning may really help. It goes to a place called the suprachiasmatic nucleus in the brain, and that's just above, it's just where the optic nerve crosses over, so it's above the pituitary. That's the optic chiasm, hence the name. And this is a light sensor. It does a couple of things, but one of the things it does is it sets a clock ticking, and about 16 hours later, or give or take, your melatonin starts to rise rather abruptly. And melatonin is inhibited by light, so that's why we are always telling people, you know, don't be exposed to bright lights at night. The melatonin levels melatonin doesn't really work orally if you just take it at bedtime.
I've had no success with it at all. I've tried it many times.
You can take it a couple of hours before bedtime, and that sometimes works. But it needs to be low dosing, so it's counterintuitive. If you take more than 3 milligrams, it doesn't work, and the best dose is probably 0.5 milligram, and it's just, you know, it's not what you think. But you've got.
Yeah, I remember hearing that.
But if you take it, you've got to keep dark after that because you'll totally wipe it out if you get bright lights in your face. And you know, the bathroom when you brush your teeth and get ready for bed, you know, that should probably be done by night light light.
Right.
If to the extent that you can. Okay, so exercise and light in your face in the morning. There is a new class of drugs that are prescription that are called orexin inhibitors, and I'll come back to that in a moment, but. There's only one out there, and I'm blanking on the name. But if you just search orexin inhibition, you're gonna find the websites that give you the name of the drug. That's something to think about trying. It's brand new, and I haven't much clinical experience with it. But I was recently at a health and wellness conference in the spring, and I had a great interview. And I'd certainly encourage you to go listen to that interview. It's on the archives at AskDrDawn.com, and it's Dr. Helen Z. And I think it aired. Maybe in June, somewhere in there. But you can go into the archive section, click on interviews, and or just run through the shows. And I know that it's listed in the shows as well. But
is that orexin?
O-R-E-X-I-N. Yeah.
Uh-huh, got it. And that's an inhibitor.
Yeah.
And this is much better than like trazodone or Seroquel. Those things are horrible.
Well, they're sedatives. This is actually, orexin is a sleep hormone that's recently been discovered. And it connects, I believe it connects to the reticular activating syndrome system. Mm. So remember I said that that spot in your brain sees the light
and then starts ticking.
Well, one of the things it does 16 hours later, besides kicking out melatonin from the pineal gland, is it also, it also relaxes something called the reticular activating system. And the RAS, reticular activating system, is what keeps you awake. This is what's broken in narcolepsy. And it's like a hairnet of neurons draped over the surface of your cortex. And they just sparkle, like those little LED sparkle webs that you buy at Christmas to put over a bush to make it pretty. Well, this, when you are awake, this is sparkling all over the brain, and it's just stimulating. And when you sleep, it's supposed to turn down. And it sounds like to me that it's triggering and you're waking up. Now, I'm not sure if it's what you're thinking, but it doesn't sound like it. It sounds like it's a real physiological
effect. Is physiological. It is, Lovie. It's exactly it. I don't think it's not thought related and the thoughts aren't negative or anything like that. It's just one went after the other.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, have you tried acupuncture? Because
I have. Okay. I've had some success with it. But you know what? I haven't slept two nights in a row since April. And that was my second part of my question.
Well, what happened in February and March in your life that changed?
You mean last year?
Well, the April that you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, in April, I had a tooth removed that was infected. And it started kind of a cascade of insomnia that's been going on since April 14th.
Did you take pain medications for it?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
I did take some antibiotics, and of course I did probiotics, and you know, since then I've done herbs and lots of vitamins, and I've got lots of supplements, and I have been doing acupuncture regularly with massage and, you know, working with those points for insomnia, but nothing has really consistently put me to sleep. I want to call them drugs, but the medication that I've, you know, received, it doesn't work every night. You know, it might work one night, not work the next night. So this thing that you said, is it RAS, the little netting that you said is on the brain?
Yeah, and it's reticular activating system.
That really rings a bell of intuitive, like, that sounds like something might be going on.
Well, that's what it rings a bell for me, too. It seems like that. Now, what do we do about it? Well, the orexin inhibitors actually work on that. So that could be a key. you probably should, I mean, I'm not normally going to drugs as my first thing, but it sounds like you've gone through all of the stuff. Red blood cell magnesium test, make sure you're not magnesium depleted. That would be another one. Your gut flora could have gotten thrown off by the antibiotics. I'm not aware of studies linking particular dysbioses to insomnia, and it sounds like something more out of sync in the brain physiology. So
that's what I think.
Yeah, it really does. Well, that's basically what I've got for you.
Okay. Well, I'm going to see you when you come back from Thanksgiving. And now, are you able to prescribe? Like, would you be able to prescribe this Orexin?
Bring in a list of everything you've tried, because if your insurance is anything like just about all of them, the first thing that we'll have to do is jump through a bunch of hoops and say, well, nope, sorry, tried that. Oh, nope, tried that. Yep, we've tried everything on your formulary. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
You have to pay for this. And it's, you know, it's just become part of what you see that haunted look in your doctor's eyes most of the time is because that's an impossible task to do for the usual size panel. And we can't get people the drugs they need anymore. And it's just, well, I'm trying not to be political this program, so we're going to leave it there. But thank you very much for the call,
and I
hope I helped.
Thank you. You did. You helped a lot. I really appreciate it, and I'll see you when you get back from vacation.
All right. Great. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's talk now to Marie. You're on the air. Hello.
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 Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
Well, I'm going to start by telling you I'm in my 90s.
Wow, congratulations.
Well, I'm not. I don't feel that way right now.
Getting old is not for sissies. I'm sure that.
It's the hardest job I've ever had. But I have spinal stenosis, and I don't know, my time machine is broken also. I don't know how long I've had this extreme body heat, and it's not fever, and it's this extreme body heat that has just ruined my life. And I've had several medications for it, and nothing seems to help. And I feel that I'm stuck with it right now. I'm lying in bed with the fan on, and that doesn't help that much because the heat is at times all over my body. It's not just my back. And in the mornings, when I get up and sit in a straight chair, I don't seem to have the body heat as much. But as soon as I lie down, it starts, and I used to go on my right side, and it was helped a little bit, and then I turned to my left side, and that helped a little bit, but now nothing helps. I keep turning, but it doesn't help my legs and my abdomen, even my arms. So,
okay.
That's it.
Well, Marie, let me first of all confirm that they've checked your thyroid and that's okay and it's not any internal physiological cause, and that there is a normal temperature when you put a thermometer in your mouth.
It is.
Okay. Is there any color change on when it's hitting your arms and legs? Is there any color change visible on the skin?
No.
All right.
What you meant, because now I've developed a bad macular degeneration. Is that, am I saying that right?
Sure.
I can't read now. I can't read and watch television. Just in the last 6 months or so, that's gotten so bad.
I'm sorry. That's a really bad thing to have happen.
Well, that's really frustrating me. But then this heat, I've had at least 2 years and maybe more. As I say, I can't figure that out anymore.
Well, before we leave the macular degeneration, let me just say that there are so many resources now for the hearing, for the vision impaired on the internet, you can, in fact, have websites read to you. You can listen to just about any book you can possibly imagine, and you can have the newspaper read to you. So these are things that are resources for you as your vision fails that will help keep you from becoming isolated and give you a way to distract yourself. So I just want to point those out.
Okay.
Are you alone in the world, or do you have family members?
No, my kids take turns helping me, and then I have some outside help.
Great.
So I'm very lucky that way.
Well, they can help.
The radio is my companion.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the radio is awesome, but then the wonderful things that are available now on computers, there, you, any book you want, Charles Dickens, anything, somebody's read it beautifully, and you can vanish into that world. And sometimes when you're trapped in a painful situation, vanishing into another world sounds pretty darn good.
Well, that's what I do with the radio.
Yeah.
But I take my mind off myself.
Exactly.
Right?
So this might be another way to do that.
Yes, I appreciate that. Yeah. I've gone to Vista.
Good.
So I know some of the things that
some
they
of the
have.
Things. Okay, so on to this heat. Now, when I walk out of the airport in Phoenix, Arizona, like I did 2 weeks ago, I feel hot all over my body, and it's a temperature, but it's not a burning sensation. Whereas if I'm in a, let's say I'm standing too close to the wood stove, there's a point where it's actually a burning. And when the pain is caused by nerve compression, there's usually a burning quality to it.
This is burning.
Okay.
So I've even said it feels like, like you have a, I can't say my words sometimes now either, a hot pad at its hottest.
All right.
I feel as though, I mean, I know there's no burn on my body, but it feels like it could be if it gets that hot.
Now, have you tried using any kind of topical agent like the Lidoderm patch or CBD or CBD oil, things like that?
Well, I have some kind of the patches I've used, even the fentanyl, is that the right word?
No, I'm not talking about, that's a narcotic, and it'll take away pain. No, but
it didn't work.
The lidocaine patch is a local numbing agent. So we use.
I think I've had that, but I put it on my back.
Right,
yeah.
We use it in zoster, that's shingles. And for people who have persistent pain after shingles, that can be very good. If that gave you even a little bit of relief, then you might want to look into having a stronger formulation made. And there are some cooling creams that can be formulated for you that are basically primarily gabapentin, which is
I've had that.
No, please let me finish, okay?
Okay.
Because you've had everything. You got to retry and do it a little differently, okay?
Okay.
So, this is a cream or a gel, and you get and they put gabapentin in the gel and they put lidocaine in the gel, and those that gets put on your body, and it's. Can be very, very soothing. So it would be worth having your doctor talk to Ray over at Loudon Pharmacy because
that's who I go to.
Because they can make these up. And ask Ray to send your doctor his sheet, maybe talk to the doctor a little bit because it's really a good thing to try. Also, it may be legal in another week, but if the marijuana thing passed, but medical marijuana topical, there's a stuff called CBD, and in an oil, I've used that on neuropathy cases who had burning feet, and it worked like a charm. So if that hasn't been tried, it's definitely something on the list. Unfortunately, it sounds like the spinal stenosis and this are linked. Make sure that you've had your B12 levels checked. Because you could have neuropathy that's aggravating it. And I'm sorry, we run out of time, so I'm going to have to sign off. But I hope that some of these ideas will be helpful for
you. CBD.
C, Cat Peter Bone.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, well, thank you very much,
You're
Dr.
welcome,
Don.
And thank you for the call. And thank you for giving me hope that I'll make it to 90, burning pain or no.
No, I don't know about that. Okay, thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Yeah, I may regret this, but I have told the universe that I actually want to make it to 90. Well, the time is up, and we're going to have to call back next month, the first Saturday of the month. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Bansky. Music by John Scoville.